So today's passage is from Philippians chapter 2, verses 1 to 4. So if there is any encouragement in Christ, any comfort from love, any participation in the Spirit, any affection and sympathy, complete my joy by being of the same mind, having the same love, being in full accord and of one mind. Do nothing from rivalry or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others.
Martin, thanks very much for reading. And if you were to turn over the notices, you'll see an outline of where we're going. And you'll see at the top a question about where you work. And the question is, how united is your team? And every retirement dinner, every leaving do, every Christmas party that I've ever heard of or been at, I've never heard anything other than, we're such a united team. It's been wonderful to work here where we're so united. And maybe you've had, worked in more honest environments than the various two-bit jobs I've had outside of churches, but I've never heard anyone say we've got a real problem with competitiveness and rivalry. But what I want to start with is showing you a really united team, or more precisely, an actual united team leader. So turn back to chapter 1. We're going to begin outside of the passage. It's page 1179, and we're going to pick it up at verse 14. Of chapter 1 of this challenging letter. Paul is the team leader, if you like, of the team that is trying to convince pagan Roman Mediterranean cities to believe in Christianity. He's planting churches, he's sending on missionaries, and he's getting put in prison for his trouble. If your job has a sales element, well, then this is kind of ballpark, but he is trying to sell Christianity to a hostile environment. But now he's been put in prison, and in general, the team that he trained has held up well. Verse 14, most of the brothers, having become more confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. I don't know if you think that would work in your team if you went out on a sales call to a client and they locked you in the basement and wouldn't let you out. Do you think that would make your team more likely to go out and, ring on some more doorbells and book up some more meetings? Most have become more bold, but here's the challenge, verse 15. There is another group, some indeed preach Christ from envy and rivalry. And he talks about them in verse 17. The former proclaim Christ out of rivalry, not sincerely, but seeking to afflict me in my imprisonment. Do you see how that would work, why they might do that? In Paul's world, preaching was all about being invited to places and your reputation. And if you're going to make a living out of it, if you're going to eat, it's all about commission. So if Paul preaches somewhere, then they feed him and they pay him. And now he's in prison, and this other group have moved in to try and steal his work, steal his gig. It's a bit like the second string actor or sports person who is delighted when the star goes into hospital with an injury. Or it's like the second rank analyst who leaps into action the moment their team leader heads off on maternity leave. I'm going to pinch their work and their clients while they're away. Paul is in prison, and they are going to preach Christ because they want to replace him. And you can see how that would feel, can't you? Unfair. Salt in the wound of prison. Terrible motives. I wonder how you would feel if you were Paul. And all he has to do is write the words that I guess have already been written today in the city 100 times in various different emails. He is the leader. He's the apostle. He's the founder. All he's got to write is, have nothing to do with them. The stinking, no good, untrustworthy snakes. Throw them out of your churches. Stop people going to hear them. And you just wait till I get out of prison. Then we'll see. We'll look down at verse 18 and see what he actually writes. He says, what then? Meaning, so what? So what if they're about envy and rivalry? So what if they are stealing my work? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice. He's actually happy about them. And he writes to tell everybody else to be happy about them too. Let them preach. Encourage people to hear them. And Paul is delighted. Now, if you were here last week, we said last week that Paul imagines every single Christian as part of a gospel tank, that we all exist as Christians to be the team that will tell the city of London about Jesus. So that there's groups of Christians in each place, each office, each kind of network of friends, and that we are meant to be as purposeful as a tank, going forwards to speak about Jesus. We're supposed to be as solid as a tank, not frightened, but in particular today, we're supposed to be as united as a tank. In Paul's world, in his day, you made tanks out of human beings, we said last week. You lined people up, gave them a shield each, and locked them in together, and that was a tank. And these rivals could have caused a major, major split in the team. The tank could have ground to a halt in the mid-50s AD in Greece, and the gospel could have never got anywhere near these islands here and the city of London. But Paul is so into unity and so willing just to sort of absorb their insults that his tank is split-proof. And I wonder if you've ever been on a team like it. You do whatever you like to me, to my reputation, my career, my pay packet, for whatever reason and motive, as long as you're still on the team, as long as you're still preaching Christ, I'm delighted. And I'll do nothing against you, even if it costs me everything, so that we can all stay together and make progress. In your place of work, how much money would that be worth to your firm if there was a course that could produce that attitude everywhere in your building? So committed to the goal of your firm that you'd suffer any personal insult and refuse to cause a split. Well, Philippians chapter 2 is the course. You're on it if you keep coming back for the next 3 weeks. Though, of course, before we could take it into your office, we would need everyone there to become a Christian first. Paul can only do this because of what he is mindful of, because his mind is full of Jesus Christ. And that doesn't produce sort of silent murmuring tranquility in a spa room. That produces white-hot, self-sacrificial, practical unity. And chapter 2, turn back to chapter 2. Chapter 2 is here because even those who become Christians and should be signed up to be just like Paul, but our track record on unity is often poor, isn't it? I visited a church just before Christmas, Sunday before Christmas, and they said, of course we can't get on with them, meaning another group of Christians. We haven't got on with them since the Civil War. So since the 1640s, there've been some apparently, immovable obstacle there. And I wonder, how about in our Christian groups in each workplace, if you have one of those? What is it that stops us stepping out together to tell everyone in the building the gospel? Is someone still offended, maybe, because when they first arrived, people weren't kind to them? Someone withdrawn because somebody once said something stupid or made a crass joke and I just don't want to go back, it's too much hassle. Maybe the other people in the group, they're not quite credible enough, you think, in the office or senior enough that you want to be seen with them. And probably in all of these groups, there'll be all the minor differences between churches that churches argue about that can be blown out of all proportion, even though I guess in your Christian group you don't need to decide a baptism policy or a church government policy for Aviva, or that's not an issue really, and yet those things can be blown up out of all proportion. Or maybe just a lot of us think we'd be better at this on our own. We don't really need other people. Christians aren't always good at unity. And that is partly because we don't always understand it properly, which is what our verses today, when we finally get to them, that's what they're here for. And it's also because we don't think like Jesus Christ, which is where we'll go next week. So on the handout, you've got four quick headings. And the first one is from verse 1 and is about what prevents unity. So look down at verse 1. Let me read again what Martin read. Verse 1, so if there is any encouragement in Christ, any comfort from love, any participation in the Spirit, any sympathy, affection and sympathy, then. And at first glance, it looks like just a sort of nice verse, doesn't it? It's about nice things, encouragement and love and affection and sympathy. But why does Paul say it? And to know why he says it, you have to look at the small logic words at the beginning, the ones that maybe, I'm sorry to do this to you on a Thursday lunchtime to make you think like this, but we have to think hard about them to know what's going on. So connects it to the shield wall of last week. If you want tank-like groups of Christians, then so, verse 1, you need verse 1. And if tells us that if something in verse 1 is true for you, if verse 1 is real for you, then you need to do the command in verse 2. If you say yes to the nice list in verse 1 personally, then you will, you can, you should complete my joy by being like-minded and being united in verse 2. And the list of things after the if, it is, it's like a great big hug, I think, this verse. It's like a great big hug from God the Son, God the Father, and God the Spirit. And I suggest that goes right to the heart of what it is that causes rivalry and splits. To give you an illustration, imagine the wise grandmother babysitting two difficult young lads. And the two boys, they are arguing over everything. They're arguing over the toys and the TV show and the food and who it is that gets the most attention. And after 2 hours of that, in the end, she just walks over and gathers both of them into one big hug. Says, you don't need to fight because Granny loves both of you. I don't know how that strikes you as a collection of senior business people today to be compared like that. But it strikes me as a devastating window into my heart when I am competitive and difficult. If, verse 1, you get any encouragement at all from Jesus Christ, is he pleased with you? Does that encourage you? If you get any comfort from the fact that the creator of the universe loves you, he made the galaxies and he is crazy about you. If participation in the Spirit seems like a good thing to you, you know, that the God who made the universe lives in your heart and travels with you on the tube to your place of work so that he can sit at your desk with you and wants to be closer to you than any other relationship in your life. Is that any good to you? These verses, are these real for you? If the creator and ruler of the universe is totally all over in love with you and values you this highly, well, then perhaps we can put into perspective the fact that they didn't ask you to lead the Bible study at the workplace group this week. Do you see, what prevents unity is the insecurity that makes me push my interests forward at the expense of other people. It's about me over other people because I'm worried that I'll lose out if I don't do that. But Paul, he doesn't need the collection plate from the Mediterranean churches. He doesn't need the fame of preaching in the next 10 cities, not because he doesn't care, but because he cares more about how God thinks about him. And he is completely secure in that. So suggestion number one, if you're in the middle of any kind of unity problem, Well, make sure you get right how God sees you and what that depends on, rather than how other people see you. Okay, second point is about what unity is not. Let me read you verse 2. It says, "Complete my joy by being of the same mind, having the same love, being in full accord and of one mind." And it sounds a bit like, you know, anything you could do together would count as unity. But if you were here last week, I hope this verse reminds you of where we were last week. Look up the page to verse 27 of chapter 1 and you'll see it's very much the same. Let me pick it up at standing firm. Standing firm in one spirit with one mind, striving side by side for the faith of the gospel. So unity is clearly there. If you look at Paul's team, it's like 100 people all doing the same thing. It's like they only had one mind. But do you notice that they are all active together? They are striving together for the sake of the gospel. And that is nothing like what most people think that Christian unity is. That's discussion question number one on the sheets. What do you think of as true Christian unity? There are weeks, aren't they, weeks of prayer for Christian unity, and there are endless organizations to promote Christian unity. And normally, in practice, it means papering over serious disagreements with a sort of surface layer of politeness so that we can hold hands and sing lovely songs together. Normally, that's what people think it means. Now, remember that Paul's main illustration is the shield wall, is the tank. What kind of shield wall would you get if you trained your soldiers that way? So back in barracks, they've ignored all the problems and they've not confronted anything and they've pretended everything is okay so that they can have a lovely time together. And you should hear their four-part harmony when they sing Barbershop. It's brilliant. But actually that, you give that to Alexander the Great, he's not going to conquer the world, is he? It's not going to go anywhere. The unity that Paul is tapping into is a unity of purpose, a practical unity where everyone thinks the same on everything important so that they are indestructible when they stand next to each other and get on with the job. See, when most people say the church should be more united, and actually they mean the church should sit in a field and hold hands and be nice to each other, that is actually just another way of saying that church isn't really for anything. Got nothing real to do, so you may as well do it nicely. How much money would your firm spend on team building if the end result was that nobody ever did any work? And maybe you think that is what they do. It would be the clear goal here is not unity in itself, and it isn't unity with people who deny the absolute fundamentals of the gospel. It's unity for a purpose. The Church of England has just appointed a man to represent us to the Roman Catholic Church at the Vatican, and I guess try and work for unity if that was ever possible. And they've appointed a man who doesn't believe that Jesus rose from the dead. And now I'm hoping the Pope will just kind of put him on the plane back again, say, thank you very much, this isn't going to work. But you can see, can't you, that kind of unity, if you actually have to cut out all the things that Jesus and the early Christians really cared about, it's just a sort of unity of no point. We're left with nothing except what nobody ever cared about and what we can agree on. No, the point of unity here is to strive for the faith of the gospel. So, point one, what prevents unity is me over other people, and the solution is a big hug from God. But, point two, unity is not about you and me hugging each other. You're probably relieved by that. No one is going to make anybody hug anyone else here at Thursday lunchtime at St. Helens. Point three, what unity is. Verse three, do nothing from rivalry or conceit, but in humility consider others more significant than yourselves. See, what prevents unity is me over other people, and unity is very simply me under other people. Consider others more significant than yourselves. And it's the same again in verse 4. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. So unity is not about doing nothing. It's not about hugs. It is purposeful and practical. And all you've got to do to maintain it is consider the person next to you more significant than yourself. Though I wonder whether that is harder than you expected. I wonder if from the example of Paul in chapter 1, I wonder if you thought he was going to say the key thing is valuing the goal more than yourself. Obviously, that's important. I guess that is what they say on the team building exercises you go to at work. If you, be about the goal, don't worry so much about each other. And it's true in gospel churches, isn't it? The goal is absolutely crucial. We have the biggest shared goal together. We have a message that can rescue people from guilt and from death. That's a pretty significant shared goal. But that is not enough on its own, because I can invent any number of goal-related excuses to split the team and cause trouble. See, Paul, with his rivals, he could have said, they're a terrible advert for the gospel, and they're preaching Christ from wrong motives. Let's get rid of them. But real unity comes from wanting other Christians to succeed more than me. In humility, count others more significant than yourself. Before the rivals showed up, Paul already wanted them to succeed more than him. So when they start muscling in, he's delighted. And do you see how practical this is? It doesn't involve pretending that there are no differences in ability. It's not about pretending we're all the same or that the other person's better than you at everything. Unity is not consider Jim better at public speaking than you, even though everyone falls asleep in 20 seconds when he explains the gospel. If you're in this the Questions of Life week, if you're going to put on an event in the boardroom at work, probably don't ask Jim to give the talk. But that is going to be a whole lot easier if your entire life has been about Jim succeeding more than you, Jim having a better reputation with the other Christians than you, Jim getting more of the credit for organising that lunch event than you, because you really think he is more significant than you, which is not a problem if you understand point one. There is enough of God's love and affection for you and Jim, so you can spend every day acting as if Jim was more important than you. And if you're lucky and he's here as well, well, then he'll do the same thing, and then the team is completely indestructible. But even if he isn't, if he's like the rivals that Paul had to face, well, it's no problem if you really want verse 3 and verse 4. Now, how do you get that? Well, if you're watching the clock, you'll be pleased to know point 4 is really next week's talk, when William will be back. But very briefly, point 4, how to get unity. You need to have the mind of Christ. You need to think only and every day the same way that Jesus Christ thinks about you and about the world. But don't for one minute think that Paul sees this as easy or without cost. It cost Jesus his life, and it cost Paul everything. So I want to ask you to do one thing by way of preparation before next week, particularly if you're currently stuck in the kind of painful rivalry somewhere that often can lead to a split. You might want to talk about this around the tables, or you might want to go home and work out on your own, but work out what it would cost you if you considered the other person more significant than you, if you decided to let them win and have what it was that they wanted. And nobody here is going to minimize or deny what that would cost you. In fact, we may even be able to help you add to it. We may be able to help point out things you hadn't even thought of that it would cost you. No one's going to minimize it. But what is going to happen next week, I think, when William is back, is that we will calibrate that cost and place it on a scale next to what Jesus did for you and for me. Do you see what we've said? The Christian church, it is for something. It is for speaking the gospel and saving lives. So we need to be forged into a tank together. And you see how this kind of unity would really help, particularly if we have to do anything that is frightening or would involve opposition or risk. It's going to help me take a risk and talk to somebody about Jesus and invite people to come to an event if I know that whatever happens, you want me to succeed, whether I fail or get it wrong or stuff it up. If I know that you want me to succeed because we are in one team together for the gospel, then maybe I would be able to take those risks and be less frightened. Let me lead us in prayer, and then Wes is going to come and tell us about question time. Our Father, we thank you for the Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, he became poor for our sake. And Father, ask that you would help us to fill our minds with him over the weeks of this series, that we would be able to stand together with other Christians in the workplace and hold out the amazing gospel of your Son. We ask in his name. Amen. To what extent does this apply to relationships in general as opposed to relationships with Christians only? And that we were having that discussion on the table at the earlier service today. In one sense, it'd be brilliant, wouldn't it? If, like I said, how much money would this be worth to the bottom line of your company? If everybody at work always put themselves behind other people. In one sense, if everyone did it, that would save so much time and money. You'd probably hold groups of people you could sack that you wouldn't need anymore, the kind of people who try and manage and keep this thing going. But what someone I was talking to earlier said, but actually, the world isn't like that. You'd be seen as weak. You'd be taken advantage of. You'd be stamped all over. And the thing William's got to do next week is show you why that doesn't apply to Christians and to Jesus. Why was Jesus prepared to be weak and it wasn't him being an idiot? So yes, if everyone did it, it'd be much better. And if you're able to model it to other people, maybe they'll step on you, maybe they'll notice. Maybe it would be better. Two questions about unity. What about those who say they are Christians but preach a false gospel? Or what should our attitude be towards rivals who don't agree about the important things, who don't believe Jesus rose from the dead? And just, if you've got Philippians open still, look at chapter 3 across the page, 3 verse 2, and you'll see Paul is very robust about people who don't have the same gospel. So 3 verse 2, look out for the dogs, look out for the evildoers, look out for those who mutilate the flesh. Which makes sense, doesn't it? If the goal of the shield wall is to go forward together and speak about Jesus, if you've got people who just believe crucially different things about Jesus, there's no sense in which you're doing the same thing together. At best, that other person is just going to want you to stop and not do it. At worst, they're actually going to be undermining what you're doing. So to preserve practical, useful unity in the gospel, you actually have to exclude those people. And the New Testament is full of both, always. Unity with the people with the same gospel, split from the people with a different gospel. So, yeah, absolutely, the two go together. And I think the shield wall actually helps explain why. Then two questions about Jim, basically. Can you explain further how we consider Jim more significant in speaking if you are the better speaker? And how do you define others succeeding? And what if that results in going against the mission? Again, I think practically, it can be quite difficult to work out, but the attitude here is really, really obvious. What I want is what is best for the gospel, that's the goal of the shield wall, and what is best for Jim. And so we're going to weigh up those two things, and what's best for me doesn't come in. And that's why I say the more you've been working at unity, the easier this is. If Jim knows that, you love him and value him and will always talk him up and never talk him down and will always thank him and always make him feel he's been valuable and helpful and will put yourself out to help in his projects that he's trying to do with telling his friends about the gospel, then it becomes really easy to say, shall I give the talk? That'd be better. And that's really straightforward. So it's, yes, sometimes it might involve taking a risk like that. But if you get the heart right and the goal right, that's where you can work those things out. Last question was about splits. Paul and Barnabas were a team, but they split. And that seemed to have helped spread the gospel in Acts. And I think that's Acts 15, if you want to look at it later. I think that fits into a series of events in Acts that should have destroyed the church and didn't, because God is so powerful at getting the gospel out. So I don't think it's recommending. So yes, it did mean that you got two teams instead of one. But I think in Acts, it's more, oh no, what's going to happen now? Oh, it's all okay. And they forgave each other and it's all right. And if you want to just check that, if you look across to chapter 4, you'll see two brilliant gospel Christians who are world famous now because they had a falling out. Chapter 4, verse 2, Euodia and Syntyche. All we know about them is that these two women had a big falling out. And Paul had to write and say, can you help them get on? So again, if you are in the middle of a falling out with a good gospel Christian who believes the same gospel as you, if Paul was writing now, he'd put your name in and say, go and sort it out and take the cost to your reputation and your pride so that you and her can stand next to each other and tell people the gospel.